rise.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Be seated, please. Good morning. Good
morning. Good morning.
We have on the calendar first case number 217-CR-30, United States versus Susan Perry, which says the government. Ms. Perry.
Your Honor, the government is ready to proceed.
What says the defendant?
We're
Mr.
Mullen.
All right, come forward with your client, please. All right, there are several objections to the pre-sentence report that we need to address first. I've got a lot of papers here. If y'all be patient with me, please. Is there anything? Are there any other objections other than the ones that have been noted by both sides from the government?
No additional objections, Your Honor.
Any additional objections from the defendant?
No, Your Honor.
All right. Any argument? There's the first one that we need to address is the two-level enhancement for offense involving 10 or more victims. Any further argument that the government wants to make?
Judge, if I may make a sort of just a general record on the objections generally and just give the court a little bit of context from the government's perspective.
All right.
Would that be all right?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so I would like to just place the government in some context, which I think will help inform the objections that we'll be arguing about in a moment. As the court is aware, Ms. Perry was one of the first defendants charged in what has become a series of cases that have jointly so far alleged over $400 million in loss, just to give the context. And to date, there have been 11 defendants charged, three awaiting trial, one convicted by a jury. And the rest have pled guilty and, like Ms. Perry, have saved the government the expense of a trial. Now, Ms. Perry is the first guilty plea of this group to be sentenced in these related cases. And as the court is aware, there's more to come. And also, as the court is aware, there are people who are watching these proceedings carefully to find a basis in making very big decisions in their lives. The government has objected to the guidelines as calculated by probation, and we realize that's an unusual position, but we do so with great respect to the diligence and the hard work that probation has put into understanding these difficult cases. As the court and probation is aware, the Department of Justice has to stay true to its own mission, ensuring that justice is proportional, evidence-driven, and fair. And so we want, to the extent possible, that it be administered efficiently, obviously. And we understand that the government's recommendations and plea and agreements and so forth with the defendant do not bind the court. But it is with that context that we make the court aware that the government does intend to and is bound by the plea agreement that we will stand by whatever the court sets as the guideline level, and we will recommend ultimately a sentence in the lower 25% of whatever guideline level the court sets, and that we're bound by the plea agreement to do that, and we'll stand by it.
All right.
Okay, so on the subject of the 10-victim objection, essentially, Your Honor, it's just the government's position that although there is this sort of one case out there and then a subsequent district court case that held that in that circumstance individual beneficiaries could be counted as victims. In those cases, Your Honor, it seemed from the underlying record, and I sort of dug into them a little bit, that in those cases, the beneficiaries were being billed for services that they didn't receive at all. And so in that sense, they didn't know or weren't aware of the billings that were being done under their name. And as far as we know, in Ms. Perry's case, the beneficiaries, the people to whom she prescribed these medications, even though they were medically unnecessary, all in fact did receive them. And so the beneficiaries may have been unaware of any fraud perpetrated against TRICARE, ultimately, which was the entity that paid the money. So from the view of the government, in terms of sort of setting restitution, it would be TRICARE that was victimized truly in this case, and that the PBMs involved, the private insurance companies that paid the money for these fraudulent prescriptions, were actually the victims. In this case, the beneficiaries themselves did receive the service that was billed, And as far as we're aware, none of them were actually harmed by the compounded medication. And as a result, because of the specific circumstances of this case, as they differ from the precedent, we would argue that there are only, in fact, about six victims of Ms. Perry's fraud, and those are the insurance companies that actually paid the money. And that in this particular case, because of the relationship of the beneficiaries to Ms. Perry, that she knew them and that she prescribed drugs that they actually received, that they would not be victims, that it's distinguishable.
All right. Yeah, you have the same objection.
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Mullins, anything further you want to
add? Nothing further to add.
All right. All right, considering the motion from the government and from the defendant regarding the two-level enhancement for 2B1.1B2A for offense involving 10 or more victims, because of the particular facts of this case, this particular case, the facts that have been related to me both in the pre-sentence report, well, I think the case law does allow me to use this enhancement. And I think the probation service is right in its position. However, since these were, in fact, legitimate patients, I think I'm going to sustain the objection to the two-level enhancement for the 10 or more victims. Now, I don't want this to be taken as a precedent. As Ms. Perry indicated, there are some things coming down the pike involving other cases. And I'm sure that this will be an issue in the other cases. But because of the peculiar facts, in this one particular case, I think I'm going to grant the objections and not count not add the two-level enhancement. All right, the next objection is to the two-level enhancement for federal health care fraud. Exceeding $1 million, saying it's double counted. Anything further you want to say on that, Ms. Perry, your objection?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe the government objected to that. So
all right,
nothing
Mr.
further.
Mullins.
Judge, I researched that further. I'm going to withdraw that objection. I believe that it doesn't specifically prohibit it. And as you know, if it's not specifically prohibited by the rules, it's not double counting.
I was going to overrule your objection.
Well, it would be disingenuous for me to come up here and try to argue that.
All right. Okay, so that objection would be overruled. Now, the next enhancement is the unauthorized use of means of identification, the two-level enhancement. Anything further the government wishes to add on that, Ms. Perry?
Nothing further, Your Honor, just the actual, I think that probation is counting the sort of claim numbers that are generated in the system as the second means of identification. And only to just say that as a sort of mechanical matter, those claim numbers identify the claim, not necessarily the beneficiary. So we just don't view them as a secondary, producing or obtaining another means of identification. That claim can't be used, in other words, to identify a human being at any point. It can only be used to identify a claim. So we wouldn't. It just didn't
All right. Thank
register.
You.
Thank
Mr. Mullins.
Judge, I just want to amplify that the application notes specifically say that the individual, Ms. Perry, would have to use somebody's identification to obtain another form of identification. And that didn't happen in this case. And it goes through and gives several examples of what would count as being counted under this section. It's if you stole somebody's credit card and went and got a loan. Those are the type of examples that specifically states that if a defendant uses a credit card from a stolen wallet only to make a purchase, then that wouldn't count. And further, if they forge another individual's signature to cash a stolen check, that wouldn't count. I don't think in this case that enhancement would apply. It seems like it's more applicable in a identification theft case. So I just wanted to amplify
all
that
right.
objection for the record.
All right, anything else from the government?
No, Your Honor.
I overruled objection to this objection. The two employees that were charged with searching out other patients, finding their, especially the ones that were TRICARE beneficiaries, and other uses, I think the probation service is correct in its interpretation of this enhancement. I think that the actions of this defendant and her employees are people she empowered to obtain this information indicate that this enhancement is properly applied. So the objection is overruled. All right, the next one is a four-level enhancement of acting as a leader or organizer. Anything further from the government, Ms. Perry?
Yes, Your Honor. I think at this time, the sort of some of the comments I made at the beginning become really relevant. We view medical professionals in these cases, the government views medical professionals at these cases as vitally important to the scheme in the sense that they are gatekeepers in a way. They have the capacity at some point to look at prescriptions and to say, this doesn't make any sense. I should not write this. I should not put my signature on this, and to stop the fraud in its tracks. But then again, so does everybody else involved in the fraud. The people who own the pharmacies have that power. The people who market the drugs have that power. And the physicians hold a special position of trust that is already included in the enhancement because of that position of trust, in the position of trust enhancement. And physicians and prescribers hold that position of trust, and their importance is already reflected in the abusive position of trust enhancement. As far as whether, as a practical matter, Ms. Perry was truly a leader organizer of this fraud, I think it would simply be disingenuous for the government to argue that she was. She was not. She was one of many, many prescribers that prescribed this medication. If we zoom out and just sort of look at the case broadly, the fraud was conceived of and began with some of the owners of the pharmacy, with the marketing companies that associated with the pharmacy. Those were the people who really directed the activities of the fraud, who made the policies, who created the prescription pads at issue, who manipulated the formulas in order to maximize the reimbursement, and who sort of pushed the fraud out to the marketers and then later to the physician prescribers who prescribed the fraud or prescribed the medication fraudulently or for kickbacks or for whatever the case may be. And Ms. Perry, we view as one of those prescribers, one of those many, many people on sort of the fringes who participated, whose participation was of vital importance to the success of the fraud, and whose criminal acts should, you know, are not unimportant. But we do not view her as a mastermind, as a leader organizer, as somebody who should be given the very highest level enhancement for their activities, masterminding and organizing the much larger fraud scheme.
All right, thank you. Mr. Mullins.
Just briefly, I think when Kate started, she mentioned that it was over a $400 million loss. And as the court knows, Ms. Perry is looking at being held accountable for $1.3 million. That in and of itself shows that she's not a leader organizer. And that's why we asked that she be given actually a mitigating role compared to what the owners of the pharmacies and the others who were actually making these drugs were doing. But that's all we have from that.
Or anything further from the government?
No, Your Honor. We would not necessarily agree with a mitigating role, but would just agree with the no role enhancement at all. Thank you.
All right, here again, as to the specific facts of this case. Now, Ms. Perry did encourage aid and use the and benefit from the actions of her employees that she either suggested or directed that they perform certain actions. I think that the particular facts of this case, not setting a precedent for other cases to come down the pike, But the particular facts of this case show that she was at the bottom of the food chain insofar as the as to where the fraud went. It started at a certain area, moved down to the marketers, to the then ultimately to the practitioners. And from the practitioners, it went to the users of the medications. So, as I said, not to set a precedent, but because of the particular facts of this case, I'm going to sustain the government's and the defendant's objection to this four-level enhancement. I do not find that she was a leader organizer because of the limited use of employees to search records. So I sustain that objection. Now the obstruction of justice. Anything further from the government?
Your Honor, the government does object to the obstruction of justice enhancement in this case. The guidelines set forth what they mean by obstruction of justice, and when talking about witnesses, and actually, if I could borrow, thank you. when talking about witnesses, there it is. The adjustment applies if the defendant was threatening, intimidating, or otherwise unlawfully influencing a co-defendant or witness. And our understanding of probation's basis for this is simply that Ms. Perry talked to Jay Shar, according to Jay Shar, talked to Jay Shar and asked him not to tell the government about the kickback scheme. She was ultimately not charged with the kickback count. In the end, Judge, the government did ask in a related case for the obstruction of justice enhancement when the government was prepared to show the court that the defendant had committed the elements constituting perjury when he had taken the stand and committed perjury. And so, that we believe that is consistent with the guidelines. We believe that the guidelines do set a fairly high standard for obstruction of justice, although we do not look lightly on the notion of people telling one another what to say and not say to cooperate with the government. We do realize that there is an interaction there with the Fifth Amendment that we want to be careful about. And so we don't believe that her conduct in this case, based on the specific evidence we have of it, is sort of this he said, she said situation would rise to the level of obstruction in this particular case.
What about the creating of medical records? I understand that there were some medical records created to cover her tracks.
Well, the government believed there was some evidence of that and was prepared to present some evidence of that at trial, certainly. But we did not come prepared to present that evidence to the court today. So that's a good question.
All right, thank you.
I suppose that would count if we had been prepared to present that evidence.
All right, Mr. Mullen.
Judge, when this the PSIR first came out and it was referenced as there was an obstruction of justice, it didn't give a specific time that the probation office was talking about. So after our objection, they specifically stated that it was during an interview that Mr. Shar gave with the FBI. And I've got that interview here.
Well, that's when she told Mr. Shar not to tell the story, not to tell the government about the payments, right?
Well, here's what was stated, and I'm going to read this, and of course I'm going to let you read it if you need to. And this is from August 2016 interview. Sometime after July 4th, 2016, Shar met with Perry in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, while Perry was having some mechanical work performed on her vehicle. Again, they both agreed that they wouldn't talk to anyone about their payment scheme. Perry also advised Shar that not talking about their scheme was in both of their best interests. That's all that was said. At no time did she ever tell, and that's according to Shar, who, his credibility is, it's a he said, she said, as Kate said, but if you really want to look at the best evidence, Jay Shar recorded a conversation with Ms. Perry, which I've watched probably a dozen times, if not more. At no time did she ever tell Mr. Schar to lie to the government about the scheme? And that's what I thought they were referencing, because that's the best evidence. And, Judge, I would ask the court look at this statement and the video to determine what was said by Ms. Perry. But, again, there was no attempt by Ms. Perry to encourage Mr. Schar not to tell the government.
What about the records, though, Mr. Mullins, the dumbing up of the records?
Judge, it's not in the report, and I don't have any evidence of that. I've requested that from the government several times, but I've not gotten any evidence that that ever happened. Not in discovery. And I requested that numerous times.
It was in the pre-sentence report.
There's never been any evidence presented that any of the records were dummied up after the fact, like in Dr. Dias's case.
Ms. Perry?
Yes, Judge, I think I can clear this up. The evidence I'm not actually, to be honest, Judge, I might need to take a moment and figure out what evidence it was the probation's referring to. We did have, pardon me, evidence in the form of the records themselves. There was circumstantial evidence about the form of the patient record itself, about the timing of when that particular form made its way into Ms. Perry's practice, about the handwriting on the records. There was some witness testimony. We never got to the point of producing Jenks to the other side, so that's why they just didn't ever have those reports. There was evidence, there was witness testimony and some circumstantial evidence that some reports were made after the fact. However, the missing piece is that we never were entirely sure why they were created, whether it was actually to flout a government investigation or an eventual one, or to produce them in response to a subpoena or what. And so, you know, we were sort of working to get to the bottom of that.
It was my understanding that the prescriptions were written and filled, and then the records were done, or the record of the evaluations was done later.
There is some circumstantial evidence of that, Your Honor, but this isn't like the Diaz case where we have sort of a lot of corroboration that they went to different people after the fact and sort of spoke with them. It's circumstantial evidence based on the form of the records themselves and based on the testimony of certain witnesses that were telling us that the form on which the record was written did not exist until later, after the time when the patient was seen. So we did have evidence of it, Judge, but we did not ever, we were never in a position to disclose those witness statements to Mr. Mullins because we never got that close to trial. So, in good faith, I can tell the court that we did have evidence that there was after the fact creation of records. I don't know that we ever had any concrete evidence of the reason for it. But there was some circumstantial evidence of the after-the-fact creation of records.
All right. Mr. Mullins, anything further?
Judge, I'm not prepared to really go into that since it wasn't used by probation as the basis of the obstruction. But there were several instances that I've spoke with the government about Mr. Schar actually creating documents from Ms. Perry's office, sort of like he did in Dr. Diaz's case. So I don't know what particular records, I've never been showed a record and said this record was created after fact for this patient. And I think it would be very difficult for us to respond without actually seeing that record and being able to go back with Ms. Perry and looking at the record and answering that to the court. And if the court's looking at that to use that for an obstruction, I would ask that the government identify the specific record so we can respond intelligently and see if we can explain what happened.
Ms. Perry?
Yes, Judge. Frankly, I think, I think we've been sort of looking through, and I do understand that probation's basis for the obstruction enhancement was, in fact, the conversation with Mr. Schar. And I think part of the reason for that is that, you know, one of the benefits of a plea, as the court's aware, is that we sort of stop the investigation in its tracks at the time of the plea. In communication with Mr. Mullins prior to the plea, I did tell him, look, we have evidence that this is what was going on. We have a lot of circumstantial evidence that this is what was going on. We're continuing to dig into it. I believe strongly that by the time of trial, we would have had a very good case, but we never quite got there. We never quite got to the point where we felt that, you know, that we knew exactly the motive and so forth. And that's because she pled guilty. We were very close to it, and we had people, sort of witnesses and so forth, that we felt would eventually enlighten us. But we, you know, part of the bargain that we struck was that we would sort of cease that piece of the investigation, that it would end. And we have these very strong suspicions. We have the circumstantial evidence, but we weren't prepared to bring an obstruction charge, for example, as we did in the Diaz case, as a result of the falsification of records that we suspected and that we had some evidence of.
All right, I'm going to sustain the objection because it would be unfair, I think, to the defendant to require her to respond to this if the evidence had not been furnished. And I will sustain the objection. So what we've got, there's the enhancements, 2 points for health care fraud. The objection was withdrawn to that. And 2 points for enhancement for the IDs, use of IDs. Is there anything further on the objections that either side wishes to present to the court?
No, Your Honor.
Not from the defendant.
Anything further from probation?
No, sir, Your Honor.
All right. Check my math, if you would, but I think there's a total offense level is, it comes to a 23. It's a criminal history category of 1. We concur with that, Mr. Alexis and Mr. Medeiros?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
All right. The guideline provisions provide for custody of 46 to 57 months. Supervised release of 1 to 3 years. The defendant is ineligible for probation. What's the fine level if you've got that handy?
It's 20,000.
Okay. Fine level would be 20 to 200,000. And the restitution would be $1,370,036.46 and a special assessment of $100. The parties recognize that the guidelines are advisory and not mandatory. Are there any other 3553A factors that the government wishes the court to consider? In this case, Ms. Perlman?
No others, Your Honor, only that the government would stand by its plea agreement and recommend a sentence in the lower 25% of the guidelines.
Any other 3553A factors, Mr. Mullins?
Judge, I don't believe they would come under the 3553, but we would like to do a variance argument when that time is
all
appropriate.
Right. So the court, based on the modifications that the court directed a minute ago, the court will, subject to the objections that were sustained, will accept and adopt the pre-sentence report as presented with those three objections being sustained. And make this pre-sentence report a part of the record. Is there anything further that the defendant would like to speak in allocution?
Yes, sir.
All right, Ms. Perry, proceed, please.
Yes, sir. I've lost my ability to practice medicine and to help people, something that I worked very hard for. I know that this has caused great embarrassment to my family and friends. Even through all this, they continue to support me. Over the last year, I've lost our family home and our life savings. The stress of not knowing. Yeah, outcome has taken a tremendous toll on my family and myself.
Just a minute, Ms. Pierce. Would you get her a cup of water, please? Just take a minute, please.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yes. You ready to proceed, Ms. Perry?
Your Honor, I have great remorse and regret for any involvement in this case. I am ready to put this behind me so my family and I can move on with our lives. I ask for mercy from the court when sentenced and respectfully ask to the court to consider my desire to continue to give back to society if given that opportunity. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Perry. Anything further, Mr. Mullins, in allocution?
Judge, briefly, I know I submitted a memorandum brief, and I know you read that. We talked about that in chambers. And I believe that, you know, I've been practicing a while, and I remember when the sentencing guidelines were the sentence that you were going to receive. And I believe now we have been relieved of that. And the courts have great abilities to do different things in different cases. And the Fifth Circuit has said as long as the sentence is reasonable, it will not overturn that sentence. I cited several cases in the memorandum brief, which I believe support a variance downward for Ms. Perry. Several cases that I wanted to talk about, but I know you read those. I wanted to talk about the Hoffman case because that's a unique case. It was a white-collar case with some wire fraud issues. And the lady in that case was sentenced to had the same sentencing guideline as Ms. Perry. And the court took several things into factor when looking at a variance. And she was a first-time offender, and she was not a leader organizer. And the district court judge recognized that and sentenced her to a term of probation. And the Fifth Circuit went through the analysis and found that that was not an unreasonable sentence. I submitted a case to the court yesterday. I don't know if you had a chance to read it. U.S. versus Musgrave.
Yes, I read it.
It was out of the Sixth Circuit. I figured you had. But that, again, was a white-collar case where there was a fraud, and the fraud was about the same amount as this case. And the court went through the same analysis, and the factors they took into account were the fact that this is a first-time offender. And the court, in that case, also sentenced the person to probation. This is a difficult case for me. I've gotten to know Ms. Perry. We've spent more time going over this case, and she's become a friend, and it's very difficult to sit up here and go through this. But Ms. Perry has, as the court can see, great support from family and friends in the audience. The number of letters that she submitted to the court gives a background of not only who she is, but what she's going to still remain after this is over. There's no doubt in my mind about that. Her age, Judge, looking at the factors, the memorandum that I sent to you shows that recidivism and protection from her in the future is nothing for the court to concern itself with. The odds of her being a recidivist is slim to none. Several cases have looked at professionals who have gone through what Ms. Perry has gone through and lost their ability to practice law or practice medicine and looked at that as a factor to consider as a variance. And I cited several of those cases for the court. Ms. Perry has been a nurse practitioner for several years. She has dedicated her nursing career to treating folks who are underprivileged. Because of her past and her two very unfortunate marriages, she endured some abuse, and she would go to women's shelters and provide free health coverage or health care for those women and their children. This is the first time that she's ever been in trouble. She's 60 years old. The court can take that into consideration when considering a variance. A few months ago, this court had Dr. Diaz in front of it for sentencing. And Dr. Diaz, as the court knows, went to trial and was sentenced or had accountability of $3.3 million as well as several enhancements, including obstruction of justice for, I'm assuming, perjuring himself from the witness stand. In that case, Dr. Diaz's guideline range was 7 to 9 years, and the court did a variance of 3 years and 6 months for Dr. Diaz. Mr. Perry saved the government the expense of going to trial. She admitted responsibility for her conduct. Her loss amount was $2.5 million less than Dr. Diaz. Taking those two cases into account, we submit that Ms. Perry's sentence should be greater or reduced to a sentence a lot less than Dr. Diaz. And based on the factors, Judge, I know it's a long shot to ever ask for this, but probation or home confinement would be what we were asking for from the court. Based on the factors, based on Ms. Perry's history and her characteristics and the support she has from family and friends in the community. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Holmes. Anything further from the government?
No, Your Honor. We just simply stand by the plea agreement. Thank you.
All right. In a string, when there's a fraud or any type of case, whether it's a drug conspiracy or a fraud case involving multiple parties, the court is always aware that whatever I do in one case will be, I'll be reminded of it by one side or the other as the future cases keep coming down the pike. But the Diaz case, as bad as it was a case where there was no financial gain. In this case, Ms. Perry has solicited and received a good bit of money as kickbacks, whatever you want to call it. And that is the primary distinction, although she did accept the plea deal and plead guilty. But those cases are different. Every case, just like every tub, must sit on its own bottom. And I will treat this case as I think I should treat this case, irrespective of what I have done in other cases or will do in other cases. Before me stands a highly accomplished individual who had some struggles. She came from an outstanding family, an accomplished family, a family that stuck together and still sticks together, that descended from parents who were committed, hardworking, decent American heroes. And it's unfortunate that this member of that family stands before this court. Also, this highly accomplished individual has obviously a number of friends and family that are in the court, the large contingent of people that have come up here to show their support, speaks volumes to the court. This court understands about the, as you pointed in your sentencing memorandum, extensive sentencing memorandum, Mr. Mullins, that I appreciated, understands the fact that white-collar crimes, the sentencings for white-collar crimes and some other types of crimes are all over the map now that the sentencing guidelines are advisory and not mandatory. And I want to point out to you that I was part of the, as a member of the Criminal Law Committee, encouraging the Sentencing Commission to adopt drugs minus two. And the next year to make it retroactive. And opposing, as a judge, I have opposed over criminalization of different white-collar crimes. And I think the commission was right. I think the criminal law committee was right, and it was done. But in this case, it involves a professional, a prescribing nurse practitioner that wrote many prescriptions, some of them for controlled substances, or whatever they were. She signed whatever they put for her. In 2001, I recognized the fact that medical practitioners were a large part of the prescription drug abuse problem in this country. In 2001, I wrote a letter to the State Medical Association, and it was published in their newsletter on the front page. And I called doctors out on overprescribing of opiates. And that was 17 years ago. Doctors or prescribers play a huge part in the prescription drug problem we have in this country. They're a necessary cog in the wheel. Without your signature on the prescription, they don't get the drug medication. I've sentenced pharmacists, doctors, nurse practitioners, and others through the years because of this prescription drug epidemic that we have. This is not a victimless crime. What has occurred, Ms. Perry, is not a victimless crime. There were people that were affected, in addition, the taxpayers, who were bilked out of a lot of money as a result of your actions. As I said earlier, you were not at the top of the food chain. You were way on down. But that doesn't change. You were a necessary cog in the wheel, and this wouldn't have happened without you doing what you did. Pill mills are everywhere. And I'm not saying that I'm not comparing you to a pill mill. That's not. I don't know. Your income dramatically increased over the last couple of years of your practice, and I don't know whether that was the result of you prescribing opiates. I don't suspect that. I'm not saying that. But that's what happens in most cases with the pill mills. In fact, one of the largest pill – I was involved in a case when I sat with the Fifth Circuit. One of the largest pill mills in Dallas was operated – by an anesthesiologist at the University Medical Center in Jackson, which was a horrible thing to imagine that a man with that much ability and opportunity would run a pill mill in Dallas, one of the largest pill mills in Dallas. But irrespective of that, that you're not being called to account for that. I'm just trying to help people understand the gravity of this problem that you are a player in, although in a small way, or were a player in. This was not an innocent mistake. This was an intentional act that you were benefited financially from. It deviated from your upbringing. It deviated from your life. The letters that I read, many, many letters from, I'm sure some of the people are here today, friends and family and patients, attest to your character. They attest to your work ethic. They attest to the fact that you have overcome obstacles in your life and become a highly functioning, successful individual to and to give it all up or to deviate in such a terrible way that affected you and many others. We all do things that we are ashamed of. But this was something that you knew was improper. Some sentences I struggle with that's, to do the right thing. And this is one that I have spent a good bit of time with. Because of all the different circumstances involving your life, the problem that you were a part of, the fact that it was a crime committed for money, and that it affected other people, including the government. But having considered the advisory guideline calculations, along with all the sentencing factors and all the other things that you have presented to me, and other factors under Section 3553A, to judgment of the court, that Susan K. Perry is hereby committed to the custody of Bureau of Prisons for a term of 42 months, as to count 1B of the indictment. It's further ordered that the defendant pay restitution in the amount of $1,370,036.46. Restitution should be paid to the respective health care benefit programs in the following amounts. The Defense Health Agency, which is TRICARE, in the amount of $1,275,157.34. CVS Caremark, in the amount of $80,536.59. Optimum Prescription, or RX, in the amount of $3,613.54. Express Scripts, in the amount of $9,935.75. And Humana, in the amount of $793.24. This restitution may be made joint in several with other defendants as the court continues sentencing people in this scheme. But for right now, there's no one else that this will not be joined in several as of today, because I don't know of who else participated in this. Restitution is payable immediately and during the term of incarceration. Restitution is payable to the United States District Court Clerk, who will forward payment to the victims listed in the judgment order. In the event that the restitution is not paid in full prior to release from custody, any unpaid balance shall be paid at the rate of at least $150 per month, beginning 30 days after release. The court finds that the defendant does not have the ability to pay interest, and the court waives the interest requirement. In ordering this nominal payment, the court recognizes that the full amount will not likely be paid prior to the termination of supervised release. In the event the restitution is not paid in full prior to termination of supervised release, the defendant is ordered to enter into a written agreement with the Financial Litigation Unit of the U.S. Attorney's Office for payment of the remaining balance. Additionally, the value of any future discovered assets may be applied to offset the balance of criminal monetary penalties. The defendant may be included in the Treasury Offset Program, allowing qualified federal benefits to be applied to offset the balance of criminal monetary penalties. Upon release from imprisonment, the defendant shall be placed on supervised release for a term of 3 years, as to count 1B of the indictment. Within 72 hours of release from custody of the Bureau of Prisons, the defendant shall report to the probation office in the district to which she is released. While on supervised release, the defendant shall comply with the mandatory and standard conditions which are listed, which will be listed on the judgment and commitment order, and shall not possess a firearm. In addition, the following special conditions are imposed. One, the defendant shall provide the probation office with access to any requested financial information. Two, the defendant shall not incur new credit charges or open additional lines of credit without the approval of the probation office, unless the defendant is in compliance with the installment payment schedule. The court is imposing these special conditions to ensure that the defendant makes every effort to pay the restitution ordered in this matter. Three, the defendant shall participate in and complete any reentry or similar program operated by the court in the district to which she is released. at the discretion of the probation officer. A fine is not being ordered based on the defendant's inability to pay and the amount of the restitution. It's further ordered that the defendant pay a special assessment fee of $100, which is due immediately. The court notes that if it erred in the calculation of the sentencing guidelines, the court would have imposed the same sentence as a variance based on the offense conduct in this case, the characteristics of the defendant, and other factors found at 18 United States Code, Section 3553. The court recommends designation to an institution closest to the defendant's home for which he is eligible. The defendant will be allowed to self-report once notice is received of the institution where she is assigned. The court has granted a downward variance in this case, a below-guideline sentence. The sentence, the court varied downward for several reasons. One, the fact that this defendant has no criminal record, has lived an exemplary life up until the time of this crime. She has significant family support, support in the community. The court does not believe that she is at any risk to recidivate. The court does not believe that she's a danger to the community, and the court has granted a downward variance. But there has to be some accountability for these actions, Ms. Perry. Professionals who have a special standing in the community and in our society have a special obligation to who much is given, much is expected. And there has to be a message sent to professionals. This court has to remind, unfortunately, professionals that they have a standard that they have to live up to, and that they, if they are not complying with the standard, that there will be consequences, and the consequences are not insignificant. And that's unfortunate, but that's if we're going to have laws and they're going to be enforced, then there has to be consequences. Are there any questions about the sentence from the government?
No questions, Your Honor.
From the defendant?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Alexis?
Your Honor, probation would like the court to impose the standard self-surrender. She self-surrendered to the Bureau of Prisons within 72 hours of designation, but no, not greater than 60 days from today.
All right. That's the, you will, once you receive your designation, Ms. Perry, you will self-report and surrender to the institution where you're assigned within 72 hours. But the designation will be in less than 60 days. Any questions from the government? Any further questions, Ms. Perry?
Yes, Judge. I just had one clarification. I may have misheard the period of supervised release following.
It's 3 years.
3 years. Thank you, Your Honor. And then the government would also move to dismiss all the remaining counts of the indictment.
All right. Would you provide me with a copy of the order? Let me make sure I...
Yes, Your Honor, we will.
Yes, I stated the term of supervised release. When I
believe you did state it. I think we just misheard it. We had a disagreement here.
All right. Any questions from the defendant? Ms. Perry, this is a bitter moment for you and your family. I understand that. There are times when I look at circumstances, look at situations, and look at people, and try to look what's behind your eyes, who you really are. And this is an embarrassing time. It's a costly time for you. But it's not the end of the life of your life. You have a lot of time left to do a lot of good things, and I encourage you, and I hope that you will. I know that you will when you are released. You will restore yourself to the community and to the family that you hold so dearly. Good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.